My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/campaign to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/campaign. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be.
Is it time to reimagine your future? The right business skills may make a difference in your career. At Capella University, we offer a relevant education that's designed to focus on what you need to know in the business world. We'll teach professional skills to help you pursue your goals, like business management, strategic planning, and effective communication. And you can apply these skills right away. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.
In this episode, Chris Rowling, CFO at CoinMe, describes how company size, stage and scale can have a huge influence on your role as CFO, emphasizes the continuing importance of building your professional network, and shares why cryptocurrency should be on the radar of every CFO and treasury team. Hi, I'm Ross, and this is the CFO Playbook, where each week you'll get insights from world-class financial leaders to help you grow your company, yourself, and face the challenges required of today's CFO. Before we jump into the interview, we want to invite you, our listeners, to head to our show notes to find a link to our listener survey. We want to learn about how to make the CFO Playbook even better. As a thank you, you'll have the opportunity to win your choice of an iPad or a Samsung Galaxy Tab S7. We'd love your feedback. Chris, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
No, my pleasure, Ross. Thank you very much for the invite.
Chris, you've had an incredible career. When we're looking through your background, there's just like so many names and locations and roles and so forth. And it is quite incredible. And even on here, you've had experience with like really famous brands like Pepsi, Kellogg's, EMI that we mentioned, Getty, and of course EY before more recently becoming CFO at CoinMe. Can you give us a little bit of background on how you've ended up to the position you're in now as CFO at CoinMe through that varied journey?
It's a tough one. I mean, we'd probably need hours in the pub to cover it all. But I mean, just in terms of highlights, I knew very much from kind of an early age that I always wanted to be international, wanted to be a global nomad, for lack of a better phrase. And really wanted to do international business. And so that was my intention from a very early age. I was a military brat. And so I was kind of used to changes of scenery every year and a half and having to adapt to new schools, et cetera. And fortunately, I had a knack for foreign languages. I had a wife who shared a passion of adventure and changes of scenery, and who, quite frankly, didn't mind living out of moving boxes, which I think I've done for the past 30 years. Really, I think my mantra was always to take the path less trodden, and I love the unknown, love taking the plunge and trying to figure my way out. And it's worked out. It's been fun and quite adventuresome. I mean, as a result of that, I've spent the vast majority of my career overseas, outside of the U.S., that is. I have lived and worked in, I think I've lived in 13 countries. I've worked in far more than that. I've traveled to well more than 100. I've lived in the U.K., the U.S., Europe, several countries, South America, Brazil, Asia, and really the last 2 years being trapped here in Seattle. And the pandemic environs has been quite challenging, to say the least. So fingers crossed I could get back on the road. But no, it's been fun. It's been enjoyable from a kind of a finance functional perspective. After grad school here in the U.S., I moved into a plant or manufacturing controller role. And in retrospect, that actually was one of the best positions I ever had, certainly from an education standpoint, negatively and positively. And then I kind of moved through audit, M&A, strategy, financial analysis and reporting, pretty much every functional area with the exception of tax or taxation, which again, I know enough to be dangerous, but I had very little interest in, and I've learned to depend on the experts. I departed kind of the mainstream finance function in 2017 when I made a move into private equity. I became an operating partner for quite a well-known private equity firm in London and was also then doing deal partnering and was working for quite some large companies. And even though I was in private equity, everything really came back to finance. It came back to cash management, decision-making, return on investment, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a departure, but it really wasn't. And in most cases, I was very much kind of an ad hoc controller to our portfolio companies. But along the way, I tended to become much more specialized in turnarounds, or the polite way of turnarounds is transformations. But quite frankly, it's firefighting, major firefighting. And I did well. And as a result of doing well, you find yourself being thrown into more and more forest fires. But that was very much my claim to fame and expertise. But the reality is I've worked for very large companies, very small companies, and I love the small startup or small company environment just because it's much easier to make an influence and much easier to kind of pivot and make changes. And I really enjoy kind of being able to see the before and after of your hard work. And I think it's much easier in a small company environment to see that and measure that as opposed to a major multinational. I've worked, as you mentioned, for major multinationals, Pepsi, RJR Nabisco, Imperial Chemical Industries, Kellogg's, EMI Music. And then I've worked significantly for some smaller companies such as Getty Images, Avantail, and obviously CoinMate, which has been around for a while, but it's still very much of a small company startup feel. You know, most significantly, I've been exposed to kind of what I call four revolutions in my career. The first was very much kind of the internet boom. And this was my career with Getty Images, where very much we were into online imagery, the digitization of stock photography. And you know, it was fantastic to have lived through the dot-com boom and bust. I then moved into a very small company called Avantail, and we were kind of the pioneers in terms of VPNs, cybersecurity, e-commerce security, et cetera. And quite frankly, we were a little bit ahead of our time, but again, quite revolutionary and quite exciting. And then in terms of music, I obviously ran EMI, and unfortunately, that was the demise of physical music, the CDs, and kind of the introduction of a less high margin version called streaming and the digitization of music. And that, quite frankly, the music industry is living through now. And last but not least, I've kind of joined CoinMate. We're going through quite a revolution in terms of cryptocurrency and blockchain. And I've been lucky. Some of it has been self-guided, but all of these revolutions have been quite exciting. And it's, as I said to start, it's been very much the path less trodden.
It's an incredible journey. And it's interesting to hear that maybe part of what made you used to, or has actually drawn you to those international experiences and moving around, is the fact that you grew up around it. Back in my consulting days, I worked with the UN Foundation and worked with people in development. And so many of the people that I met in development, their parents also worked in development. So they'd grown up moving around, trying to contribute to different communities and countries as part of their upbringing. So it became normalized, which sounds quite similar to yours.
It's funny you say that, because my children are scattered. So I've got kids in London, in the US. I've got a daughter who's living in Nairobi, Kenya. You're right. It's in the genes.
Yeah. And so that just means that when the pandemic eases, you've got lots of places that you have to go and visit, presumably. So the other part that's fascinating as well is that, so you've been through, like, as you said, so many industries, so many different waves. And Even with the boom and the bust that you mentioned of the dot-com, we're going through a very interesting period right now where we had the pandemic, and even in the run-up to the pandemic, technology companies, both public and private, were going through this incredible increase in value and almost like domination of markets. But that's in the last few months really come down quite significantly, first in public and now it looks to be in private markets. Given that you've lived through this at least once and kind of seen this rodeo before, what's your take on the way that technology stocks and companies are being valued at the moment?
No, it's a good point because obviously working for a private company now, I'm very involved in fundraising. We're just about to kick off, you know, a Series B. And quite frankly, there is no science to company valuation. You know, you can triangulate. And I face this as a private equity professional where I had the money. And quite frankly, that's an easier side of the table to be on. Now I find myself on the other side of the table where I'm looking for money, trying to raise money. And it becomes a negotiation. And it's more of an art rather than a science in terms of the valuation. Quite frankly, I think things were becoming very, let's say, I don't want to say dot-com oriented, but valuations were actually starting to race a bit ahead of the fundamentals in the company. And because we, you know, are still EBITDA negative at the moment, very much our valuation comes down to sales multiples. And some of the sales multiples in our space have been very much 10x, 15x. And I still remember doing deals where I would argue with somebody if they wanted 2x. I would say, no, we'll pay you one-time sales. And so I think certainly in the case of CoinMe, where we're going out to raise money, I would prefer that we stay with these lofty valuations and I argue the valuation from a high point as opposed to trying to negotiate bottom up. But overall, I think for the industry, for the startup community, for certainly some of these cryptocurrency firms or blockchain firms, I think it is healthy that some of the air comes out of the bubble, so to speak. And these are very, very difficult businesses to value. In our case, because we deal with tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of customers, we're very focused on customer value, the cost of customer acquisition, et cetera, et cetera. And quite frankly, as long as we have the data and we can capture that data using, you know, new technologies and new data analytics, we stand in a much better place to be able to negotiate with these venture capitalists and these private equity firms and these, you know, private investors to justify the valuation that we're going out for. But you're right, it's very, very frothy. A lot of people have taken advantage of it. We've been very successful in terms of raising money. And as I said, we're just about to go out into the markets and we'll see what happens. But I do have some deja vu moments to kind of back in the late 90s.
And the dance is, of course, is that if you've managed to raise significantly before there is any, let's imagine there might be a little bit of a retrenchment of funding, then that's great. But then because you've got the cash, but then the danger is that you've got this benchmark and as a valuation that you can never live up to. And then it becomes, in some cases, a weight around your neck, which I actually saw firsthand at Dropboxes. Everyone was fixated on their last funding round before IPO, $10 billion at the time, which was a big valuation. Nowadays, it's not. Everyone gets that. And they just couldn't get to that for public, or they only just got there after many, many years. So it's a very delicate dance for, especially for a CFO to manage.
It is. And the other delicate dance that we have is very much, you want to ensure that you've got enough cash runway. But you don't necessarily want to raise more than you need at lower valuations. Therefore, you end up diluting your ownership, et cetera, particularly, obviously, if you're a private company. And so it's a very, very delicate balance for me or for any CFO in a similar position in terms of we need accuracy in terms of cash burn and cash runway. We don't want to raise more than we necessarily need because of dilution reasons, yet you want to raise enough that you've got an adequate runway in case the markets turn or you're not able to raise money, et cetera, et cetera. Luckily, we're in a space that is quite popular. There's a lot of money chasing. We actually, because we've been pioneers and we've been around in this space for 7 years, we have a certain reputation. We've got some credibility. It's highly regulated, which again gives us kind of a trust factor. And so I think we're in a much better space to be able to go out and justify higher valuations and raise money than perhaps some of the other people who may have jumped on the bandwagon, so to speak, later. They don't have reputations. They have no cred in the space. And as such, I think some of that will fall out as the market becomes much more regulated. But no, it's a very, very good question. I live it day by day.
I can imagine. And for CFOs, the fundraising and the associated M&A piece is such a big part of the role. And you mentioned, I thought that was very interesting, that you've pretty much covered all finance functions in depth, with the exception of tax, which you know enough to be dangerous. But is there one above others that, of course you have responsibility for everything, but is there one above others that you have a particular affinity for?
I mean, I think the more value-added piece of the business or of the finance function is very much kind of in that financial analysis, the reporting space, et cetera. Certainly when I was at Pepsi and Kellogg's and some of the other major multinationals where I had a much, much larger department, we very much focused on business partnering and actually having finance directors or finance individuals embed themselves within, say, the sales function at Kellogg's, or they would embed themselves into the sales organization. And they would basically, on the one hand, be kind of my eyes and ears into the organization, but on the other side, they were very much value-adding partners, albeit with financial expertise, to the people running sales and marketing and on and on and on. And marketing, particularly difficult in terms of trying to understand return on marketing investment. And I've never cracked that nut. But I would say that the partnership with the other functions and kind of that financial analysis and assisting in decision making, I enjoy that. I think that's more of a value add. But obviously, doing the bread and butter, the controllership, the preparation of the monthly accounts, the dealing with the auditors, it's fundamental and it's necessary. But I do like that, the more value adding in terms of that finance function.
And many people mentioned as well the idea that, of course, the stewardship piece of it, which is like keep people out of jail, keep the company on the right track, it's like critical. But the strategic advisor that the CFO becomes is so critical. And whilst your team's out business partnering with all the different departments, you as CFO are partnering with the CEO to run the company.
Correct. Correct. Now, I've always viewed that CEO-CFO partnership as being, you know, absolutely instrumental. And I've actually turned down job opportunities where they wanted the CFO in, say, Chicago, and the CEO was going to be based in London. And I just walked away and I said, no, we've got to be in the same space. We talk 24/7. I can end the sentence of my CEO before he can say it, and vice versa. And it's a very collaborative relationship. We don't always agree, obviously, that I think is healthy. At the end of the day, I work for the CEO, but it's absolutely instrumental. And I think what's been tough for the CFOs that have worked for me as a former CFO is I have very certain styles in terms of, look, your job is to keep a lot of stuff off my plate. I don't want any surprises, so make sure I'm not surprised. But a good CFO is going to keep a lot of the things that I really don't need to be involved in off my plate. And that very much is my style. And the CEO will often say, well, I didn't know about that or what. And I'm like, well, that's good. I took care of it. It's done. And you can very much concentrate on the customer, concentrate on the investors, and concentrate on strategy. But I can't overemphasize the importance of that relationship.
And you've been on both sides of it, of course, as well, where you've been in CEO positions, CEO positions. So you can see it from that perspective too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's The other thing that I found interesting as well is you've delved into other roles that are like outside of finance, but of course we'll always have a financial aspect to it. But you've been pulled back in, back into finance, or been drawn back in. What is it that's drawn you back to that role as a finance leader time and time again?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have enough of a sample size to call out any trends, but the move back to CoinMe was very situational. I joined about 3.5 years ago. I had left Hong Kong for family reasons, and it actually worked out in retrospect to be quite good timing, and really wanted to get back into the startup community. And I had been away from Seattle for, my gosh, 18 years. And the network was still here that I had left in 2002, albeit we were all grayer, fatter, poorer because our kids were in university, et cetera, but there was a diaspora of the same people that I had worked for. And everybody was telling me, well, you can't really, even though you're from Seattle, you really can't break back into the community. You need to rebuild your credibility. You need to rebuild your network. And there's no better way of doing that than going back into a startup and having to raise money and having to hire people and having to build partnerships, et cetera. And CoinMe came out of nowhere. I virtually knew nothing about cryptocurrency, blockchain. And again, it was this leap into the unknown. And the position was very much a finance position. I think I was employee number 16 or 18. And I viewed it very much as a build, very much as kind of a risky play, but a way in which I could get back into the community, the startup community, rebuild a reputation that I had left in 2002. And it's worked out incredibly well. And the company itself is still relatively small. We're still just shy of 100 people. And so whilst it feels big to some of the people that come from startup environments, for me, with 30,000 people at ICI, it's still very small, very cozy, and quite frankly, very manageable. And I always come from a keep it simple philosophy, and let's not overcomplicate. And because we're hyper growth, we do overcomplicate things at times, and we actually sometimes run as if we're a 2,000-person company as opposed to a 100-person company. And I very much view my role as one of reason, of common sense, of let's do this step by step, let's do this measured, what are the facts, what is the best return on the limited amount of cash that we have. And stepping back into that finance position allowed me to really do that and capitalize on, as you call it, my war record and all of the scars that I've accumulated all over the world. So it was quite situational, but has worked out quite well.
As you mentioned, the ICI or even some of the other companies you've worked with, they're like super global, multinational enterprises, huge scale and complexity. But then you've been in like this very early stage startup, which has hyper growth. So part of what you bring, and you may have alluded to this, to the table in a startup is you've seen scale, so you know what has to be built. But then the artistry of it is not building too much too soon so you become cumbersome and it slows you down. What's the difference for you between being a finance leader in the huge multinational or in the startup, and how do you approach that?
Now, it's funny you say that, because normally I get the question, how have you been able to move from country to country? Clearly, they're all different, and they are. But in the finance function, it's probably 70 to 80% of the same. Obviously, there's nuances in language and terminology, and I've never seen as many acronyms as I've seen in the world of cryptocurrency and blockchain. But the reality is, I've actually had a harder time or a more challenging time big company versus small company. And that transition, I think, is much more challenging than picking up and moving from Germany to Switzerland or to Italy or whatever. And obviously, there's challenges with that, cultural challenges, language challenges. But as a finance guy, that was relatively an easy transition. the challenge of moving to a small company or a startup is you need to build that platform. The team becomes much more important in terms of having a team and basically hiring ahead of where you are at the moment. So hiring big. So basically, I need to hire a controller who's capable of running an international 300-person business because I know that given our hypergrowth, CoinMe will grow into that person. And that's very challenging because you need to find a very experienced person who's willing to step back, move into a startup environment, and that's not easy. And in the very early days, well, early days, 3.5 years ago when I joined CoinMe, I often felt as though, and I was often treated, even by the Big Four, as almost kind of the CFO of a leper colony. Nobody wanted to touch crypto. It was taboo. They're bad actors, on and on and on. And fortunately, we took the high road. We became very regulated. We spent millions to do it. But 3.5 years ago, it was very challenging to hire people into crypto and blockchain. And so again, I had to find people who were willing to take that risk, who were willing to almost kind of take a step back such that they could then take two steps forward. And so the team element was significant, and I've been blessed. We only have 6 people in finance today, including myself. So it's a very small team, but it's a very capable team of doing the job at hand. And despite the fact that we're knocking on the door of international, and I don't see having to add for probably another year or so. And that's because of the quality of the team. Now, in terms of technology, you basically somewhat have to do what you can afford. And because there's many different clamoring parties all for the same pot of money, finance, number one, I have to set an example, and I'm not going to go out and spend vast sums on technology that we may need later. And I'm very focused on the basics. When I joined 3.5 years ago, QuickBooks was fine. It worked. But I very quickly realized this is not going to scale. It's not going to cover me for international. Finance at that point was me and another guy. And we've now migrated to NetSuite. It's working incredibly well. Initially, I used to tell the investors, well, we only close quarterly. Well, the reason for that was we struggled to close on a monthly basis. And we're now closing in 8 workdays. The accuracy has gone up. I think what we now need to do is invest. And we're currently trying to figure out, okay, now what tool is that? But we're currently looking at that area of financial analytics, data analytics. We've hired a number of kind of data scientists. The vision, I think, is quite clear. We know things are going to become much more complex as we move internationally. Every partner that we add, there's some nuances, and we need to adapt accordingly. Regulation is coming down the pike. Fortunately, as I said, we took the high road and spent millions in 3 years to really basically kind of anticipate, if not surpass, the regulation that was in play at the time. And so I think we're ahead of the game there, but it's a tricky balance. So, you know, I certainly know where we're heading. The team has been much more important to me than the technology per se. We're looking at some new tools, budgeting tools, but it's worked well. And there's been some late nights and some angst, but now it's tidy and we're doing a good job. And now we can start to concentrate on that business partnering.
I don't think it's possible to work in finance, let alone a scale-up, a hyper-growth scale-up in finance without the late nights. So what's interesting as well is that, of course, you started when you're talking about technology investments in your team, which are two themes that we often like to touch on. One is the idea that, of course, part of the reason you can have such a lean and mean team is that you're using technology to try and to automate things and to give them more time to do that business partnering and that analysis. That's a very clear theme that we hear from a lot of guests on the show. Is that something that you've seen change over time, or was that always the case if you think back to some of your earliest roles as CFO?
I think that's been the trend, and obviously technology has gotten much better. I think the other aspect, that I very much have been going through for the past 10 years is the ability to outsource. And so where back in my Kellogg days and Pepsi days, everything was in-house. And we, again, kind of took the plunge to say, well, can we actually outsource finance or closing the books? And we looked at financial services centers, Costa Rica, India, the Philippines. And I've kind of been there and done that. And it's worked in some cases. And in other cases, it's been the circle of life. And what we outsourced became insourced. And I think it's very situational. In some cases, it works. And in other cases, it doesn't work. But I think the ability to hand off to people who are specialists, experts, who can leverage the technology has provided one angle and one opportunity such that I don't need to build that in-house and I can very much outsource. But in terms of crypto, it's a highly transactional accounting type system. We need to know for every customer, when did they buy the crypto? What was the price? We have to calculate the fees. We have to calculate what state they were in because of state reporting, on and on and on. And so there's a tremendous amount of data. We have KYC, know your customer data, which could be potentially valuable from a marketing perspective, and on and on and on. And so I think the challenge that we're facing is we have a tremendous amount of data. How do we sift through it? How do we throw out the outliers? How do we come up with meaningful statistics? And that's something that we're kind of learning as we go, particularly from a cryptocurrency and blockchain perspective. But it's a natural trend, I think, for technology to, let's just say, supplant to some extent the human resource side of things. But I've seen it go wrong, and I'm a firm believer in the circle of life. I think what we need to do is serve the customer, either externally or internally, and use the technology to do that in the best way we can. And where technology won't allow us to do it, we do it, you know, through the old-fashioned way, blood, sweat, and tears.
Yes. And you mentioned that with your team, of course, is that it's become even more important with such a small core team to hire people that are ready for your future 2 or 3 years down the line. But you were also suggesting that it was against the backdrop, I'm sure, of the pandemic, which has been challenging. And then you're in an industry where not everyone wanted to join. There wasn't a lot of certainty around where it was going. So then how were you able to, or how do you try and get the best people in that context?
Yeah, it's, a fantastic question. 3.5 years ago, it was a massive challenge. And what I had to do is say, hey, look, I'm a normal guy. Look at my background. If I'm willing to take this plunge, you know, ride with me. I mean, we're both wearing the ankle braces for the bungee, and I'm going with you. And I'm not completely crazy. So it was very much trying to portray the strategy, the vision. We're in this together. And it worked in some cases, and it didn't work in other cases where people just said, no, not for us. If you fast forward to the current day, I'm beating people away. All of a sudden, we've become the cool kids. Everybody wants to work in cryptocurrency. It's become much more Main Street. The financial institutions are starting to get involved. Yes, there's still going to be a regulatory shakeout, which, quite frankly, we think is good, and will just open more water vis-a-vis our competition. But we're cool now. And I have more interest from future employees than, unfortunately, I have room for. The other thing that's interesting is, as I said, I felt very much as if I was the CFO of a leper colony 3.5 years ago. I couldn't find banks to open up operating accounts. I couldn't find an auditor to do audits. Never before have I pleaded for an audit. And now all of a sudden, hiring is not an issue. Banking is not an issue. In fact, we actually just recently had a bank invest in us, and that could open up quite a significant opportunity for us. And I've got the Big Four knocking on my door, but it's really come full circle. And it's actually quite fun. It's quite enjoyable. The early days were quite dark and quite challenging, but now we're in the limelight. And again, it's a good problem to have because now there's nowhere to hide. Now the attention is on us. We've got to perform. We're now raising big time money. And so the stakes go up, but it's a completely different world, than 3.5 years ago.
And crypto is such a fascinating innovation and area because it has made people ask questions that they'd never asked before. I certainly did the same, which is for even in the case of Bitcoin, is like, what is value? How do you value something? What is money? How does that work? And then the idea of even centralized monetary policy. A lot of people, you just accept the way the world works and you assume it's a norm and crypto upended that. So it's fascinating to hear the insider's view. But now with crypto, as you said, it's reached a tipping point. It's on the verge, there's certainly big companies like Coinbase that are huge, and there's lots of others in the ecosystem, and blockchain is another technology where there's lots going on. But what's your view on where crypto is likely to go in the next 5 years, given where it's come from?
I'm not going to go down the rabbit hole of, is it a store of value? Is it counter-cyclical to inflation? On and on. We view it very much as a new technology and a much more efficient and effective way of remitting money, of payments. And then obviously we have a lot of customers that view it as, you know, an investment, they trade it, but all three of those markets are $1 trillion markets, be it the remittance market, the payment market, and the crypto trading market, et cetera. And fortunately, CoinMe spans all three of those. And so we very much view, you know, Biden just came out with an executive order, basically giving the green light to the various U.S. departments to come up with cryptocurrency regulation practices. And that's really been kind of the difficult thing for us is we have a lot of state regulations, but we don't have a lot of guidance from U.S. GAAP, from the SEC. And quite frankly, we welcome that. And we view that announcement as being quite beneficial just in terms of providing some guardrails in terms of where we're heading. And also, it will separate the wheat from the chaff. There's a lot of people out there that are fly by night, that don't do the KYC, that aren't necessarily regulated. And quite frankly, we welcome that regulation because that will make their jobs that much harder. And there could be some acquisition opportunities in the future. Others will fall by the wayside. And whichever way we see it, we see that as being good for CoinMe. So we think from a technology perspective, it makes the world much more efficient. There's a lot of developments in terms of central bank coinage, stable coins, which will take some of the volatility out of it. And that has been the hardest thing for me as a CFO is we don't necessarily speculate or trade in whether Bitcoin is up or down. So we essentially collect a transaction fee regardless of whether somebody buys or sells the currency. And quite frankly, volatility actually is correlated with trading volatility. And so as there's volatility, there's more trades, which means there's more transaction fees for us. And that's what we're driven by, is how do we increase customer retention? How do we increase customer transactions? And for us, we see people using cryptocurrency to remit back home, be it Brazil, Philippines, Mexico, etc. And it's a much more elegant way of remitting money than the normal remittance markets. We've actually partnered with MoneyGram. MoneyGram, I think, has woken up and realized the cryptocurrency actually offers a new and more efficient and possibly less high margin, but greater transactions in terms of being able to remit money. And we're working very closely with MoneyGram. We're working very closely with some other remittance companies. And from a payment space, PayPal's getting into it. Amazon is now looking at receiving payments in crypto. It's happening. I think what's kind of surprising is the speed of the transition or the revolution, but crypto and blockchain definitely have some inherent advantages in those three spaces, and we're seeing it and living it.
So for any CFOs or financial controllers that might be listening, do you think that we're nearing a point at which companies will complete B2B transactions, you know, accounts payable and receivable in crypto or some form of cryptocurrency?
It will happen. You do see some companies, kind of more bleeding edge, leading edge companies doing it. I think what we'll need to deal with is very much kind of the volatility, and that's where the stable coins may play into it. Because the difficulty that I have is, yes, we've got some inventory every month of crypto, and you have to mark to market it. It's very much like a foreign exchange. And so my balance sheet will jump around from a crypto asset standpoint, very much depending on pricing. And it's very difficult to kind of explain to an investor what your net worth is, what your assets are, when you've got this tremendous volatility. And so the finance departments of the future will very much, you know, need to have that acumen to basically take care of that. Now, I've suffered through that with Argentinian devaluations. You now have the Russian issue, on and on and on. And so it's virtually no different from a foreign exchange type situation. But that whole area of treasury, I think, will adapt and evolve and start to incorporate cryptocurrency. There's no question in my mind. It's just a question of how they do it, how they minimize volatility. It's a global currency. It's traded every minute of the day. The large institutions are getting into it. It's inevitable.
It's fascinating to think about that, especially the idea of like having to market and the volatility that you mentioned, like, and not being able to estimate assets. Chris, as we draw the interview to a close, I often like to ask guests, and I would love to ask you as well, especially given you, the breadth of your experience, for anyone that's listening that's an aspiring CFO that works in finance and would one day like to be in that position, and of course, we want them to be successful in that role, what advice would you have for them so that they could be prepared for it?
It's a tough question. I somewhat look back on what I've done well and what I haven't done. From my viewpoint, take a chance. Take the path less trodden if you're presented with that choice. It may be scary. It may be undefined. In some cases, you may not have that opportunity given family issues, et cetera, but take the path less trodden. And I can't remember who it was, but somebody once said the road to success is always under construction. And I can't tell you how many detours I've taken, how many U-turns I've taken. I've run off the road. I've climbed back on. I've broken down. It's basically, there is no one way. And I think exploring the unknown, taking chances is fundamental. I would say going international, absolutely fundamental. And granted, I fully appreciate that some people cannot do that. But having spent my entire life and career international, that has been hugely educational, both certainly personally as well as professionally. And so I would say, if there's an opportunity to move out of your comfort zone, by all means, take it. Some other, I don't know what to call them, hints, I guess, would be become as commercial as you can. Very much, even if you're a CPA and you love doing the bread and the butter, step out of that, go into some business partnering, go into M&A, or raise your hand for projects that are out of your comfort zone, because variety is essential to learning. And so I would say that oftentimes I fought battles that I had no chance of winning. And now in my older age, I've kind of realized don't fight battles you've got no chance of winning. And that's when you're a young buck who knows it all and on, that's very difficult, but pick your battles and fight accordingly. The network is absolutely fundamental. I mean, my greatest asset is the fact that I've worked in so many different companies, so many different countries, so many different functions, that I've built and maintained a network of colleagues, peers, customers. And it's funny how the world is actually a very small place. And you run across people that you dealt with 10 or 15 years ago. And fortunately, I've maintained and I've cultivated that network, and it's paid off thousandfold in terms of me being able to go out and recruit, me being able to fundraise, me being able to mentor or be mentored. And so I would say fundamentally maintain the network, don't burn bridges. It will become your greatest asset down the road. And I lecture my kids on that and they're like, yeah, dad, sure. But I fundamentally believe in that the network is absolutely essential. But those in kind of a nutshell, that would be it. But it's very much take the leap of faith and jump off the bridge and hope the bungee cord holds.
I love the phrase, the road to success is always under construction. I think that's great advice for anyone. So Chris, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
My absolute pleasure, Ross, anytime. Thank you.
One last thing. We want to hear from you, our listeners, to learn how we can make the CFO playbook even better. Head to our show notes to find a link to our listener survey. As a thank you, you'll have the opportunity to win your choice of an iPad or a Samsung Galaxy Tab S7. We would love your feedback. This show is brought to you by Soldo, the brighter way to manage business spending and expenses. With Soldo, you can control every expense, track spend in real time, automate financial reporting, and then use those insights to fuel growth. Learn more at soldo.com.